Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Cozy Vine for May 5th, 2024. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, good to have y'all both on the show, and we're excited tonight. In about 20 minutes, calling in from Split Ticket will be LaShia Jane, who's been on with us probably, this will be at least his third appearance, but he's also having join us Armin Thomas of Split Ticket. So we're glad to welcome Armin in the show for the first time. So we'll have them on talking about all of their research they've done for election 2024 in just a few minutes. But until then, we got a bunch of little different topics to talk about, ones that in some ways may have flown under the radar but still are pretty important, particularly to the three different states that the four topics across of them cover, although a lot of times, as we've seen in state houses, what happens in one state will begin to happen in more and more states until it's a third, a half of the country. And we're going to start off with Wyoming. Now, I guess it really was a few weeks ago, but I think it really just started to get some attention last week. Wyoming purged its voter rolls, and that will happen from time to time, and that can be a controversial process. But sometimes it'll be like if you haven't voted in the past four cycles, five cycles, maybe even three cycles, that kind of thing, and that's usually even year cycles, they'll purge the voter rolls. And people, you know, make good points about why you shouldn't do that. Well, Wyoming is saying if you didn't vote in the 2022 elections just 2 years ago, one cycle, they're going to purge the rolls, and they've apparently already done it. And it's about 80,000 voters and 22% of the state's, you know, registered voters at this point. It's a massive number I've never seen and mentioned in one purge. Catherine, what are your thoughts on what Wyoming's doing?
Well, I think it's a little bit premature to do it in one cycle. So if they voted in 2020 but not in 2022, they're off the rolls, right?
Yes. That's why I'm understanding.
Yeah, so that means a lot of people skip midterm elections. Either they're not, you know, well-informed, or they're not interested, or in some cases there's really no reason to vote. If you have, like, you know, really strong Democratic or Republican districts, and there might not be any reason to vote. Or, I mean, there's always a reason to vote, but it might not be as imperative. So I think that's pretty dramatic. Personally, I believe in purging after three cycles, because that's how you get people who have moved, who have died, or, you know, changed addresses or changed their names or stuff. And I think it's important to update the records, or you just end up with these enormous voter files that are inaccurate. And for those of us who make do mailings and, you know, organizations that do mailings and phone calls, it really does add to the weight of the voter list. So I'm not opposed to purging, but you need to give people a chance to vote.
Yeah. Since you brought that up, Catherine, I will say this. I watched that movie, or I guess it was more of a documentary, that Amazon did called All In. It featured Stacey Abrams pretty prominently, and she kind of made some interesting points. I think there are some logistical issues, like you mentioned, but she said, you know, if you don't go to church for, you know, 12, 14 years and you decide one Sunday you don't return to church, you don't lose your right to freedom of worship. if you decide you've never owned a gun and you want to own a gun, then you can have a gun. You go out and buy one as long as you're not, you know, mentally incapable or have a criminal record, whatever it may be in your state. But you don't lose that. And so why should somebody lose the right to vote if they don't practice for that period of time?
They haven't lost the right to vote. They just have to re-register.
But they may lose it for that cycle because they may not know that they got purged, particularly under something of just 2 years.
That's what I say. I mean, 2 years is ridiculous, but I think, I don't know. I'm not crazy about it. I'm not going to die on that hill, but I do understand the need for it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to get Tim on here and get his thoughts before I make up, you know, touch on other points. Tim, when you saw this, I think you actually commented and did some of the math for us. What were your thoughts on Wyoming purging almost a quarter of its voters?
Yeah, actually, is 83,500 voters, and they said that's a 28% drop. This law should be changed is what I think. They've had this law for 50 years. Every county clerk is required in that state's 20-some-odd counties. I believe there's 24 counties, something like that, to go over the voter rolls every February and purge people. It is my understanding even that they're so picky about it that, say, if you voted in the primary in 2022, which, let's face it, in Wyoming, guys, the primary win is tantamount to election because that's pretty much just about a one-party state. It's the most Republican state in the country, as a matter of fact. And so if you voted in the primary but not the general election, they're kicking people off the rolls for that, too. I think they're pushing it a little bit too far, especially also one thing they have in common with other states, less people vote in the midterms than they do in the presidential election. You will find that they will not purge as many voters after a presidential election year as they would after a midterm election year. But the funny thing about this is that they're kicking a lot of Republican voters off the rolls out there. They have to be because it's a Republican state that sometimes the presidential candidate has been known to get 73-74% of the vote in that state. So they need to change the law.
Yeah, that's the thing is a lot of times we feel that when they take these kind of actions, they may be targeting certain voters. But in Wyoming, you're targeting white voters, you're targeting Republican voters, and these are white Republican officials doing it. So I don't think they're purposely targeting anybody for those reasons. That just doesn't make good logic. Yeah. I wonder if they found that voters that vote all the time, they feel are more, you know, vote in maybe more of a business type interest that some of those politicians are supporting. If there's any, calculated angle they're going with by, you know, having this very, very rigid, almost perfect attendance voting patterns. Do you know of any, Catherine?
Well, but Tim said they've been doing this for a long time, so
yeah.
It's not like they just started it. So it doesn't seem like that would be unless that's an ongoing goal that they've had for, you know, decades. So it sounds to me like, depending on Tim, did you say how long they've been doing it?
Yeah, it's been in effect for a little over 50 years.
Yeah, so 50 years ago. It was probably really hard to maintain a voter file if it was predominantly Republican. I mean, that's a lot of paperwork, a lot of and maybe they were just trying to ease the process. And so they said, well, let's just purge it. So, but they haven't revisited that law because now you know, with the electronics, it's a lot easier to manage. So who knows what the original incentive was, but I don't think it's, in a state like Wyoming, I don't think it's a target.
Yeah, and it is the smallest population state in the union, if I'm not mistaken. So
it is.
It'd be easier to actually manage the file per capita. You know, you just have, you know, less people there. It's probably not a very transient state, I would think. You know, even within people moving within the state or with people moving into the state and out of the state, just less population. So it seems like there's no real advantage there either. And they in 50 years, I mean, we've had computerization of business-type files for longer than that. Jim?
Well, I was going to say, I wonder if in-person voting is a big thing in that state because of the fact that it is so – it is a huge state area-wise, much, much bigger than Georgia, for instance, which is the largest state east of the Mississippi. But it's very rural, and I imagine it's tough for a lot of those rural folks to even drive to a polling place. And it seems like a law like this would just make, would just suppress the urge to vote. If a person finds out before the fact that they're not registered anymore, they might say, oh, to heck with it. I ain't going to drive 50 miles to re-register or whatever it is they have to do. So I don't see where there's an angle that makes this better for the party in power in that state. I could see the Republicans doing this in more populated states that are more competitive to try to, you know, garner an angle. But I don't see where they get any major benefit from doing this. It seems like they'd want to make it as easy as possible to register, stay registered, and vote in that state because it's their voters, right?
Yeah, and one thing that's interesting is, you know, we've seen in the last roughly three cycles, and we're talking special elections in between that, that Democratic voters, really highly educated voters more acutely, have been showing up more regularly to the polls. So even a state where there's very few Democrats, like Wyoming, but there are pockets like near Jackson Hole, it may be that more Democrats get to stay on the rolls because they voted in 2022, they voted maybe in a special election since then, and therefore they're going to maybe – you know, tick up a percent or two in a state like Wyoming. Certainly not enough to win it, but could even flip some state house seat somewhere. So it'll be interesting to watch. It just doesn't seem like good government. It's not left or right government.
No.
It's just good government. It's just not helping the will of the people to just kick people off after missing one time. And what's funny is, you know, we talk a lot about, say, voter ID, but if you hadn't voted in two, three, four cycles, whatever it is, but you still live at the same address and you could pull out your driver's license, you could pull out a phone bill, a power bill, some type of bill with your address on it to say, look, I hadn't moved, so I hadn't changed districts. You know, that seems like that would be another way to keep you on the voter rolls when you show up at the polling place. So we'll see if there's any backlash, although you think we would have heard about this before now, But, Tim, this has been going for 50 years. Catherine's been going this long.
Yeah.
Had either one of you heard about this until just this week?
I had never heard about it.
No, I didn't know it was that strange out there. I did not know.
And
that.
I just checked to see if what their voter registration deadlines were. And it looks like they're like 2 weeks before Election Day. You know, some states have same-day registration. If they had same-day registration, then it wouldn't be a big deal. But theirs is like about 2 weeks.
Yeah, Minnesota is the state that I know has same-day registration. You know, so if Minnesota can figure that out, it seems like a lot more states, including Wyoming with this rule, would want to do that. Well, let's continue to talk about some of these smaller state issues And this one we've known about for a few weeks now, and it's gotten a lot of press and attention, and that is in Florida. They've passed a new rule. If you're released early, you're in prison, and you have good behavior, they decided that whatever your crime was not something that you need to serve the full sentence. You get released early on parole. Then all of that time period that you get released, their estate is now going to charge you $50 a day that you have to come up with. And I don't know if they charge it week by week or they charge it saying, hey, when you get out, you're going to owe, you know, $750 because we're letting you out early because we had planned on you staying here like it was a hotel. And, of course, you know, you could say, well, these are prisoners. Well, you know, why are we, you know, defending them in any way? But if somebody's in prison, they're not making money, then we have this big bill that they're going to come out with, and they don't really probably have, you know, great job prospects lined up. Aren't we just setting them up to head back to prison? So we're kind of defeating the purpose there, besides just being punitive. Tim, what's your thoughts on this Florida law of, you know, charging almost like a reservation fee for a prison cell?
Yeah, it's called pay to stay, and the law does say it's $50 a day, and it's based on the sentence of the prisoner. And that means even with early release, they have to pay for what would have been their full sentence, and the authorities don't even have the option of taking into account whether or not a person can pay. They don't care. I read a story, David, about a woman who served 10 months of what was supposed to have been a multiple-year sentence, and she got out, and she got her life straightened out. She's doing good, and she suddenly finds out from the state that she owes $127,750 from her original sentence, and she finds this out 7.5 years after she gets out of prison when she's trying to finish college. This will ruin her financially. She has a family, a husband and a daughter. It'll ruin the whole family. And I'm sure there are all kind of stories just like this. Again, we have ourselves a ridiculous law, wouldn't you know. It's in Florida. The legislature toyed around with a bill that would have given judges at least the right to do an ability to pay assessment on these fines, but it went nowhere.
Yeah, Catherine, we refer to, you know, the prison system, the legal system by different names. And sometimes it is like the justice system. We're getting justice. But at other times we talk about corrections, reform. You know, we're trying to change people, like maybe they're not doing the right things for society. They have to be punished, but we want to set them on the right track to, in the future, do the right things. Is this type of law helping in that?
No, it's ridiculous. I was really shocked by that. And that story that Tim just told was a horrible example of how, you know, if they don't even know, you know, they're not like presented with a bill at the end of their stay. Can you get like auto checkout or something? I don't know. I think it's just further, like you said, it's just setting them up to fail and not be able to.
Florida, and later on we're going to talk more about Florida, but right now I want to welcome into the show from Split Ticket for about the third time, LaShia Jane, and welcome, LaShia.
Hi, guys, and with me is Armin Thomas, another partner at Split Ticket. We're so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us, guys.
Absolutely. Good to have you both. Well, let's start off right there. Armin, good to have you on the show for the first time. Tell us a little bit about your background and what you do with Split Ticket.
Yeah, so I am actually, focus on the Senate races for Split Ticket. I'm a co-founder of the site. So built it up from, you know, very humble beginnings a couple of years ago to what it is now. And mostly, you know, I like looking at demographics. I like looking at, you know, different idiosyncrasies of making, you know, conclusions as to why places vote the way they do. So, yeah, I'm happy to be here and discuss whatever it is that you want.
Yeah, well, we're going to have a myriad of questions. We've been reading your site, of course, all the time and following on social media and whatnot. But I wanted to start out with, because I know either one of y'all can jump in and answer this, but look, Shy, I've read a lot of your social media where you've talked about the polls. And the whole polls, to, I guess, use one of those words that I like to use with numbers, they've been noisy. They've been hard to understand while we're seeing different things, particularly when we get into the crosstabs. Try to explain what we've been seeing over the past, say, 6 months with the polling.
Yeah, so, I mean, I want to distinguish two things from each other. The first is that the electorate right now is in no way, shape, or form the fan, anything like what you would call a fan of Joe Biden. You could go on the street and you could ask a bunch of people, do you like Joe Biden? And I'm guessing you would get some pretty similar responses in most of the country. And while usually selection bias is a real thing, when you do surveys, you get the same thing. No matter if you're Republican, Democratic, or Independent, people don't like Joe Biden. That part in the polling is very likely to be just on the money. The thing is, though, that most people don't actually like Donald Trump either. And so you have a really – at a time when it's really difficult to reach people in polls, it's really difficult to get a representative sample, and you've got two historically unpopular candidates, it gets harder than ever to create and conduct an accurate survey of the race, especially considering that the election is 6 months out from now. And so the first part is, you know, I want to stress that in no way, shape, or form are we claiming that Biden is popular. But a lot of the things that we're seeing right now tend to suffer from two problems. First of all, when you're trying to reach voters, you really have to make sure that you, A, properly design and sample your survey. If you have opt-in online surveys, a lot of the times you get the most engaged and the most idiosyncratic types of people. And this cycle, a lot of them are very angry, very anti-Biden. Marginally, that does shift things a little bit towards Trump. The second thing is expressive responding. People who are in surveys generally tend to express just their sentiment rather than how they vote. Marginally speaking, a few of them tend to say, like, oh, I'm just angry, and they vote, and they say they're going to vote against the incumbent. That's expressive responding, and that has cost Biden about a point to a point and a half in polls right now, as per, you know, estimates of people at, like, top election firms as well. And we see it, and we agree with that assessment. So to start with, when you see the top line at Trump plus one, there's two factors that go into it. I do want to stress, though, that Trump has gained ground since 2020. It is true that if an election was held today, at this minute, consisting of the people who would vote in November 2024, if you made them all vote right now, Donald Trump would be the favorite because people are angry, people don't like Joe Biden, and the only reason that Biden still has a chance is because no one really likes Donald Trump either. To start with, that's how I break down the top lines.
Yes. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask y'all about before I ask, you know, let Tim and Catherine ask questions, is going to be about young voters. Y'all actually did a piece on young voters, but that seems to be the group in, or the age group in polling that's really the one that's hard to figure, because you'll see in a poll where it's, you know, a mix of ages, you may see, you know, Republicans performing with younger voters better than almost any poll we've ever seen, but then we see a poll of just younger voters, and it's much closer in line to, say, 2020, 2022, you know, 2018 and 16, and the way it breaks down. So y'all did that that actual piece about younger voters. Tell us what you're seeing with that under, say, 30 group.
Yeah. The under 30 group is really difficult to survey as well, because those are the voters that respond least to any type of phone call or survey outreach. They have the consistently lowest response rate, and so it's much more difficult to assemble a representative sample. But what we see in that group is, you know, we see polls that say, like, oh, Trump is leading by 18 among young voters. And the truth is that this is really an artifact of weighting and survey design rather than an accurate measurement of the electorate itself. If you actually stratify your survey, if you break down your survey into little tiny buckets that make that group of young voters weighted by age, or by race, by gender, by region, by partisanship, and you actually conduct a poll like that, you'll actually get something slightly different than what the top lines all suggest. And the reason for this is very simple. Polls are meant to represent the electorate, but they represent the electorate by weighting different groups to be a percentage of the electorate. It is not true, however, that those different groups that are weighted are also representative of their portion of the electorate. What I mean by this is that you may have a poll that says young voters are 18% of the electorate. Okay, but your young voters in that poll are usually going to be like 60% male, or, you know, 65% male or whatever, when in reality, in the electorate, 48% of young voters are male. So you have errors in these different subgroups that mean that analyzing the crosstab gets very dangerous. And that's why you get things like Survey USA and Fox News at Trump plus 25 or so, because they're checking an electorate that's been skewed heavily by different weights and does not represent it. When we do our polls and we represent the young vote, we still get, you know, Biden in trouble. He lost a lot of vote share, but Trump is not popular with these voters. Our sample, our probability-based survey had Trump at, you know, negative 40 favorability, and he was still down by 10 to Biden. And that doesn't change the top line of the poll. We still have Biden in trouble with the electorate. But the reason for that is different than what a lot of pollsters are claiming right now.
Yeah, and one more age question, but I'll go to the other end. I've seen it when I've looked at the crosstabs of polls, and I have a pollster that I trust that told me that they're seeing the same thing in their polling, that Joe Biden's actually doing better with voters over 65 than any Democrats. Are y'all seeing that change on the other end?
We're seeing that he's holding up better with voters under 60, voters over 65. That I will agree with.
Yeah.
But he's not making some massive surge with old voters that's unprecedented in some way. And what I would say by this, what I mean by this is that, look, if you think Biden's struggles with the youth are overrepresented and overrated, then similarly, the countercutting point against that is his surge with old voters is also similarly overrated. It's a sampling thing. Old voters tend to respond to polls at higher rates. Liberal old voters tend to respond to polls at higher rates than more Republican older voters. And if you weighted those polls for old voters by demographic and partisanship, you would also find that Biden is probably not gaining by as much as you think with old voters. He is gaining some, or he is holding up better than people than he would have otherwise. He's holding up better than he is elsewhere. He's losing less support. But no, he's not. I really, really, really hesitate to say that Biden is putting up a massive retirement wave surge.
Okay. Well, I thank you for those questions. I'm going to pass it to Tim and then Catherine for plenty more, and if there's anything else, I might pick up another question at the end. Tim?
Good evening, gentlemen. Look, Shia, my first question is for you. Your site is called Split Ticket. That's a catchy political name, but in each election recently, the number of voters in this country who actually split their vote continues to decline. Will this continue until split ticket voting is no longer relevant in a meaningful way?
I think that it's dangerous to extrapolate that, because it is true that polarization is ticking higher and higher and higher. And mm-hmm. I expect it to increase in 2024, at least from 2022 levels. But when you have two really unpopular candidates, the truth is that the election starts to become a choice between parties rather than – and a choice between candidates rather than a choice between, you know, like, do I like Joe Biden better or do I like Donald Trump better? It's who do you hate less? And in this age of media and polarization, everyone tends to get swept under one banner. It's why the Republican candidates don't outrun Trump's numbers in the suburbs any longer from like Trump 2016. If you look at 2022, virtually no Republican candidate was consistently outrunning Trump's 2016 numbers in the suburb. And that's because this realignment has trickled down so deep that the voters who used to call themselves swing voters now simply consider themselves, you know, voters of one party. For example, you can have someone who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012, Katie Porter and Joe Biden and Gavin Newsom in 2020 and 21. Those voters are just called Democrats. They're not called Republicans any longer, even if they may be registered as them. And in fact, the decline of split ticket voting is probably the most evident in a place. Actually, Armin can tell you more about this, in South Texas.
Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead and tell me about South Texas, and then I'm going to ask you a couple of U.S. Senate questions.
Sure, yeah. So I live in the Rio Grande Valley right now because of, you know, where my situation has taken me. And the basic story of South Texas is that for 140 years, the Republican Party was pretty much non-existent in the Valley. That's a legacy of Texas being a solidly Democratic state, as well as a number of other local concerns and, you know, things like that. And now, in 2020, a number of factors that, you know, we're going to work on a piece to talk about, and, you know, no one has really pinned down a singular cause, but there are many causes of it. For a number of reasons, now the Republican Party exists. And there are a lot of people here who very much are attracted to, you know, Donald Trump and his type of Republicanism. If you remember back in 2012, when Mitt Romney lost, a lot of people attributed that to the, you know, I guess the off-putting nature of the Republican Party towards minority voters, and how they would have to moderate their image on racial issues to win elections more. And, you know, you look at what Donald Trump has done in 2016 and 2020, and, you know, he kind of has gone the opposite from that direction. And he's, you know, done some of the, you know, put up some of the best numbers in places like this. And if you look at, you know, the split ticketing, it's still, you know, very much in an early realignment stage because, you know, judging by voter registration, you know, everybody is still overwhelmingly voting in Democratic primaries. You know, a lot of the local elections and stuff are still very much there, and congressional and state legislative incumbents are still doing a lot better than the top lines would suggest. You know, it's in the news a lot now because about an hour and a half away from where I live is the 28th District, where, you know, the, I guess, famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, Congressman Henry Cuellar, he's gotten indicted for, I don't exactly know what, but some amount of corruption. And, you know, the trends in his district with, you know, the extremely low rates of education and the extremely low income and, you know, the general, you know, polar diametric opposite profile from where Democrats tend to be improving elsewhere in the country, you know, the trends are pretty good for Republicans, you know, just looking at it. And so, you know, seeing someone who is normally a really good overperformer like him perhaps, you know, be, you know, tarred or, you know, marred by, you know, the scandal of potentially, you know, even a replacement or something like that, it's going to be legitimately interesting to see. And with the, you know, Texas being one of the only real offensive capability areas for the Democrats in the math to, you know, maybe try and hold the Senate, you know, every vote matters, especially in a state as big as Texas. And so they're going to be really, you know, they're going to really need to find every vote that they can and make sure they don't lose any. So 2024 is really going to be a test to see if, you know, the Republicans can repeat their ginormous, you know, 30-point swings or whatever, which for a number of reasons, and we'll go into the articles about why, I don't necessarily think those swings of that magnitude will repeat again. But, you know, I think there's definitely more room. There's definitely more room to, you know, to see Democrats fall, you know, depending on the areas. But, yeah, South Texas is honestly, there's no real place like it anywhere else in the country. That I can definitely say.
Well, I wanna take you up north, Armin, to a state that used to be considered a bellwether state, a tipping point state, not so much now. And I want to talk about the U.S. Senate race in Ohio. Now, Sherrod Brown is the only statewide elected Democrat in Ohio, and this is a presidential election year. And we know that Donald Trump won Ohio by about 8 points 4 years ago, and he's favored to win there pretty comfortably this year. Yet, you guys have the Senate race in Ohio rated as a toss-up. Why is that?
Yeah, so we changed the rating because, first and foremost, there was some daylight as to which of the candidates the Republicans would actually put up. And they ended up putting up Bernie Moreno, who, apart from Vivek Ramaswamy, might be the worst Republican candidate in, you know, Ohio that could potentially have actually run that race, right? He has a history of, you know, shady dealings from his, you know, time as a car dealership owner. And, you know, he's not necessarily as toxic as an Ohio Republican like J.R. Majewski, who, you know, lied about his service and, you know, was at the January 6th insurrection. But he generally fits the mold of somebody who's said a lot of caustic, you know, hard right Trumpian talking points. And, you know, Brown, by all accounts, is not a terribly bad incumbent himself either, right? And the story of 2022 was that, you know, split ticket voting is in fact declining, but, you know, when Republicans nominate subpar enough candidates, you know, that is, you know, sort of a fail-safe to get voters out of their polarized stupor and to make them think on the merits of the race itself, right? Like, if you look in 2022, J.R. Majewski, Lauren Boebert, right? Marjorie Taylor Greene, even, and Matt Gaetz, right? A lot of those seats, they're too red for you to notice it, but they did a lot worse than you would have expected to just by virtue of the fact that it's those people who are running there. And, you know, you're going to see a similar effect in Ohio, too, as well. Adding on to this is all the stuff that we've written about with respect to how Dobbs is affecting things in Ohio, right? Because they have issue one, they have issue two as well, and, you know, that's in the Constitution as well. But, you know, Sherrod Brown, you know, very much has, you know, some benchmarks that he realistically could try and clear in terms of hitting his margins in suburban Delaware County and, you know, trying to flip it outright and then just sending it in the places, you know, the three C's, right? Cincinnati, Columbus, and Cleveland. You know, those areas, you know, he's going to, you know, he has to really supercharge the turnout. And then in terms of, you know, looking at the 2022 Senate race, right, that I think is the instructive comparison because, you know, obviously Sherrod Brown is not going to win his 2018 margins with, you know, the Northeastern lakefront, you know, steelworking types that he, you know, typically the bedrock of the Ohio Democratic Party. But J.D. Vance, right, who is kind of a similar hard-right Trumpian, you know, figure who is catapulted into relevancy by the Trump endorsement the way Moreno was, he underperformed against Tim Ryan, who, you know, Sherrod Brown is from the lakefront, Tim Ryan is from the Mahoning Valley, you know, they're a little bit different that way, but in terms of that, you know, old school, they have a record to run on, and, you know, they have that reputation and goodwill in those working-class white Ohio communities. They're kind of similar in that regard. And so Tim Ryan, you know, he did better than he should have or had, you know, ought to have based on the electorate that showed up in 2022. And Sherrod Brown, I would hazard a guess, is probably a little bit better of an incumbent than Tim Ryan is. So you put, you know, what could be a bluer electorate, you put the focus on Dobbs, you put Moreno's weakness, you put Brown's strength, and, you know, we're not saying that Brown is favored at all, right? Ohio is still a red state. It's Trump won it by 8. You know, he could win it by a similar margin. He could win it. You know, it's very unlikely Biden wins it, right? But there are enough factors out there to give us pause to say that Brown could actually, in fact, you know, pull that win out.
Okay. So with my last question for you, and then I'll send it over to Catherine for some questions. I want to go east. And Larry Hogan, who you've also written about, a very popular Republican governor in a very blue state. I still do not see a path to victory for him in that U.S. Senate race. Is there any possible way that he could find the magic and win that race?
So I'm originally from Massachusetts, right? So I know a thing or two about crossover moderate Republicans and, you know, how they, you know, how their electoral coalitions operate. So the first thing I would say about Larry Hogan is that he is, you know, often, you know, labeled as part of a trio of, you know, Northeastern moderate, you know, that's the word they use, moderate Republican governors, right, along with, you know, formerly Charlie Baker and soon to be formerly Chris Sununu in New Hampshire, right?
Yeah.
And if you look at the coalitions, right, in 2018, the last time all three were on the ballot, they all won very, very handily and very, very impressively, right? Sununu won by like 30 or whatever in 2020. Baker won by 33. You know, I voted for him, right? And in Maryland, Larry Hogan, he only won by about 15, right? And he's, you know, got a similar profile to him, right? And why is that, right? What does Maryland have that the other two of those states does not have? Is a very, very large contingent of black voters, right? And black voters, you know, even if they vote for Trump or whatever, right, all of that curiosity is driven by lower education black voters, in which Maryland has some of the highest educated black voters in the country, right? Prince George's County is a huge hydrogen bomb of Democratic votes, and it is, you know, very much, you know, not at all fertile ground for Republicans, right? The last Republican to do well there was Larry Hogan's father in the 70s and 80s, when he was a congressman of a much wider electorate back then. So at outset, right, Larry Hogan's ceiling is a lot lowered just by virtue of the fact that, you know, black voters are just, you know, very strong, very rock-solid Democratic voters, right? You compare that to Massachusetts, where, you know, it's much wider. Charlie Baker basically won about two-thirds of white voters, right, just because of, you know, who he was. And, you know, he also did very, very well with the black vote, but in a state like Massachusetts, that's just simply not as important to a statewide victory. Whereas in Maryland, you know, those black voter margins are actually going to be very important. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is the idea that, you know, with the black vote, who are the Democrats going to nominate? By all accounts, there's a very good chance, and, you know, I'm not the Maryland expert. You know, I wish Max McCall, who is our Maryland, you know, guru, was on this call because he'd be able to tell you a lot. But there's David Trone, and then one of the other people who has a very, very good chance of winning is Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. And she is the black woman. She's elected by a black electorate. She is not going to let Larry Hogan win or something percent of the black vote just like that. I'm sorry, she's just not. And then, so that's two. And then the third thing is, in order to win with Maryland, right, you have to win a decent amount of liberal, you know, that liberal white voters in places like Montgomery County and in places like Baltimore County. And, you know, those are people, you know, the DMV white liberal is the archetypal, you know, profile of what's been termed the resist lib, right? You know, the people who in the Trump era have basically made it their life's mission to just
deny the Republican Party any sort of political power, right? Mm-hmm. And Larry Hogan is the one Republican that they like, right? It's sort of like how in Massachusetts, a lot of the resist-lib types, they love Charlie Baker and they say that they'd vote for him if he runs, right? But the Democrats are doing a lot to, you know, and they'll do a lot to paint him as someone who will just, you know, cave to Republican demands and vote for Republican judges and, you know, vote for Republican priorities that they're not aligned with, right? It's the same with, you know, it's the same how we all agree that if Charlie Baker, right? It's the same with Larry Hogan. I do not see a path for Larry Hogan to actually win. I think he'll overperform significantly because that happens, but Maryland is simply too blue, it's too black, and it's got too highly engaged of a population, right? If you look at past attempts at this, right, Steve Bullock in 2020, Phil Bredesen in 2018, Ted Strickland and Evan Bayh in 2016, the most apt comparison would be Linda Lingle in Hawaii in 2012. Right.
Yeah.
Now, granted, Barack Obama was on the ballot in Hawaii in 2012, but at the same time, you know, Hawaii and Maryland are kind of similarly blue, you know, in terms of partisanship. So I do not think, you know, it would be accurate to say that that is, you know, something likely to happen that Larry Hogan would win. We don't like to project certainty, but I would say Democrats have a better chance of winning Florida than Republicans do of winning Maryland.
All right. Well, with that, I'm going to send it over to Catherine for some more questions. Catherine?
Hey, fellas. Thanks for being on the show tonight. It's great to have two wizards with us. I have a couple questions. I looked back at some of the posts on your site, and one of the ones that really intrigued me was the electability ideology sort of review that you did of the 2022 elections. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on, like, ideology and policy for the 2024 election. Like, are we looking at primarily, like, jobs and the economy? Or are there other hot-button issues that are going to pop up either nationally or regionally?
You know, there's the way that I would look at this, Catherine, is that I personally feel like, if we've spent 50 years fighting about abortion in this country, it's not going to go away as a topic now that it's illegal in half the nation. And, you know, I think 2022 showed that Dobbs is front and center in the electorate's minds. And it's as long as the door is open for Republicans to introduce a ban of some kind, it will continue to be salient. And that's why I think that'll probably end up being among the top issues in this election, if not the top election. I think the Israel-Palestine war actually is getting a lot of attention on social media, and it's a very complicated conflict, but I actually think that's an instance where people may be overshooting the importance of you know, a foreign conflict, because historically – Americans don't vote on what's happening overseas unless it directly impacts us, unless there's actual American bodies and boots on the ground in those nations, or unless it's got such global implications that it shocks the supply chain and impacts things here at home. You know, it's going to get more attention than a lot of the conflicts have in the past that the U.S. wasn't directly involved in, but, you know, ask yourself, I just asked myself, right, like, when was the last time an election swung on a conflict that we weren't directly involved in? And the answer is you'd have to go back a long, long time. Not Kosovo, not Ukraine, you know, not Serbia or anything, not Rwanda. It's just really difficult to see that being the tipping point. People say Vietnam with the college protests. I don't think so. The reason Vietnam was impactful was because Americans literally had a draft that they were all subjected to. So issues-wise, I think in terms of ideology, it'll be abortion front and center for this upcoming election. And if there's going to be a second issue, it could be immigration or it could be lagging economic sentiment. I think more likely to be immigration because the economy is improving And so Republicans are less likely to weaponize that.
Okay. I tend to agree with that, especially with the results of the 2022 election and the impact, and also the other elections that have come since then, the special elections. It seems like Dobbs was really important. Now, my other question is about cannabis. So right now, I think a little more than half of the states have legalized recreational marijuana. And it's, I don't know if it's on the ballot in any states, but I'm just wondering, like, at what point is the federal government going to recognize this, you know, overwhelming support of legalized marijuana? Because the federal government has a lot of control over what happens. You know, there's all these problems with the dispensaries and banking and delivery across state borders and all these things that really only the feds can control. So what are your thoughts about that, if you have any? Maybe you haven't looked at that. I don't know.
You know, I think cannabis is something where we've actually written about, we've written about the electoral consensus growing on it, but remember that it's significantly less popular among older voters than it is among younger voters and millennials and even Gen X. And the majority of politicians, or a plurality, are still rather old. And this is one where you'll probably see that as the old guard starts moving out of politics, cannabis ends up moving down the scale of, you know, illegality federally, so to say. And this is where, you know, Biden, for example, is pretty anti-marijuana. He reclassified it to Schedule 3 from, I think, Schedule 1, but, like, throughout his presidency and throughout his tenure as a politician, he's been consistently not super liberal on weed. And that's actually just a function of the fact that he is 82 years old. And when your question was, when would the federal government get in line with what popular American opinion is on it? And, well, that consensus has only really emerged over the last decade, and it's very difficult to see politicians who are really set in their ways and in their 80s change tack on an issue like this that quickly, especially when a lot of states have legalized it already. So there's not really that much pressure for those politicians to act. Absent pressure, why would they change their stance when they can kind of continue their beliefs as is? So I think in order to see a change, you're going to have to see a change in the presidency beyond Biden or Trump. You're going to have to see the next Democrat come in, be substantially younger than they are right now, and that may induce a change.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
As an old American, I must be the exception to the rule. Well, thanks very much, guys, and I look forward to reading more about what you're writing. And I'm going to pass it to David now.
Thank you.
Well, guys, we thank y'all so much for both coming on the show. Let us know, our listeners, we know, but let our listeners know how they can find Split Ticket and where they can find either of you or both of you on social media.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. We really enjoyed being here. You can find our website at split-ticket.org. My social is LXEagle17, and Armin's is Thorongil16, Thorongil16. Thank you for having us, David.
Yes, good to have both of y'all on, and we're going to keep following Split Ticket and get your thoughts as this election moves. And I have a feeling, since we're still so far out from November, we're probably going to get one or both of y'all back on the show prior to the election, if y'all are willing.
Oh, that would be lovely.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, Armin, thanks for coming in for the first time to the Kudzu Vine.
Thank you so much. I love being here. I hope to be back.
Thank you very much, guys.
All right. Well, that was – yeah.
Armin Thomas, LaShea Jane, a team from Split Ticket, do find their site, do see their research, follow them on social media, because there's a lot of stuff that they're going to post in between those studies and weigh in on. But, guys, good show tonight. And next week we're going to have from Wisconsin our Wisconsin expert. You know, Armin was talking about their Maryland expert. We've got our Wisconsin expert, Dr. Anthony Chagosky of the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. But since we had such a thorough discussion with those guys tonight, I think it's time to call it a night on the Kudzu Vine.
Okay.
Good night, guys.
All right. All right. See y'all next week.